But I want to start a new term, conspiracy deniers.
I like that.
I mean, how did the word conspiracy and theorist get to be the same word? I mean, like, you can't say one without saying the other. You know, because I always say in my talks, you can call me a conspiracy theorist if you call everyone else a coincidence theorist. You know. But I mean, either we're both historians or we're both theorists. I mean, they even had a series on Katie Couric's Today Show. It was called Truth or Conspiracy. Well, that's a good way to frame it. It's got to be either truth or it's got to be conspiracy.
Yeah, it's one or the other.
Yeah, it's one or the other. You know, but, or the left will say, well, there are limited conspiracies. I mean, there are, like, you know, government operations, but, you know. But they think there's only, like, there's either that or you're talking about the Illuminati and seven guys in a room that control the world for the last 10 centuries. Well, you know, that isn't my view either. Mm-hmm. I agree with Ishmael Reed in Mumbo Jumbo. He has this opening quote, and he says, the real history of the world is a history of competing conspiracies. Because conspiracy is just, in the Latin, conspire, to breathe together. Some people have worse breath than others. You know. And, of course, people conspire, we conspire, you know, in terms of those that don't like us. I mean, it's all perspective. To the British troops, weren't the American revolutionaries a conspiracy, and weren't they terrorists?
Yeah, that was actually, wasn't that the first time they transferred the spelling over from the French version of terrorist mm-hmm. over to the current spelling, was the British describing the Americans, because they wouldn't stand in a line like the British did. They'd shoot from behind those trees.
And be shot.
And it was totally unsportsmanlike.
Right. Well, that continues up to the present day when they invaded Grenada and they talked about the diehard Cubans. You know, diehard Cubans. Well, which means that you won't get up and stand in front of my machine gun fire, you know. Or you'll dig a tunnel under us like the Vietnamese and shoot us from behind, you dirty rats. You know, you're just supposed to stand up and die, damn it. Well, you know, I mean, both sides play those games, but it's all a matter of perspective. And a terrorist, like they use the term themselves now, asymmetrical warfare. What do they mean by that, asymmetrical? It means that one side's not balanced with the other, which is the point. I mean, of course, the American colonists didn't have the wherewithal that the British military did. So they developed a different kind of warfare based on what they had and what they could do, and on their own protection as a smaller force. You know, so yeah, it's guerrilla war or, you know, insurgency war, or, you know, and you can call it terrorist, but I mean, is it any less terrorizing when this huge military force comes in? You know, were the people in Nicaragua terrorized by what we did there with the Contras? You know, did we terrorize people in other parts of the world when we bombed them? You know. But what they mean classically now by a terrorist, it just means that there's a small faction who will use violence, you know, and often violence that kills civilians, but that's not even separate from current warfare. The level of civilian deaths in World War I was 4%. By World War II, it had gotten up to 25%. By Korea, it crested 50%. By Vietnam, it was at 85 to 90%. Counterinsurgency war, which is basically the war in the post-World War II era, when you're not going to have whole nation states generally go against each other because they're too evenly matched. And there's, you know, I mean, and the kind of weapons now that are at people's command. I mean, we now have what they call a generation of near nuclear weapons. And they have the same physical effect as a nuclear weapon or worse, but they don't have the radiation. That's like these fuel air bombs that were tested in the Gulf War that create the equivalent of a nuclear firestorm without the radiation, or what they're calling now, this cute term, daisy cutters. You know, bombs that just level everything and have the physical effect of the nuclear blast, you know, and the shaking of the ground and over a huge period and level everything, you know, cut down to the grass level, you know. Anti-personnel weapons that are very, very devastating, that are only anti-personnel weapons. These cluster bombs that were used in Vietnam and again in Afghanistan, they were using them. They don't penetrate a tank tire or a jeep tire, you know, or a tank tread. They don't They don't go through a sandbag. The only thing they penetrate is human flesh. They are specifically anti-personnel weapons. They are weapons that kill humans. And that's all they do. I mean, they would kill an animal, you know, and they probably do damage to a plant. They're not going to do anything to other machinery. And during Vietnam, because the way they'd make these things, it'd be like one large bomb would drop, and it got to a certain altitude, the air pressure would cause it to burst open. And these little bomblets, as they called them, bomblets, would come out with like airline, like ridges on them, so they'd flip around, you know, kind of like a curveball, you know, and go in all different directions, 360 bomblets per bomb. And they're flying all over. And then when they get to a certain level, they burst. And inside of them is all this shrapnel. And then the shrapnel spreads out. And, you know, they had others like these mines that they would leave on the ground. And then when you got near them, they'd pop up and then burst the shrapnel all over you. So the Vietnamese got at least somewhat proficient in X-raying people, getting into their internal organs and trying to stop the bleeding. Honeywell, the producer, the contract producer of those specific kind of bombs, started making them out of plastic at the end of Vietnam. So they couldn't be X-rayed, and they couldn't save the people's lives. And I'm sure that there was a plastic version that was used in Afghanistan. Afghanistan already had 10 million unexploded landmines from the earlier war that we funded at the Soviet Union. So there were daily instances of people setting off those landmines. And there's still a tremendous amount, like 10% of unexploded munitions in Vietnam, that to this day blow up, you know, when you drag a plow through the wrong part of the earth. And, you know, and there's a landmine problem all over the planet. But Afghanistan had more than anybody else. So when the U.S. was dropping these food supplies in there, this pittance of food, I mean, 7 million people displaced, and they're dropping 30,000 food packets of food that they don't even eat, Pop-Tarts and, you know, peanut butter out in the desert, and, you know, stuff that they were feeding to their mules and, you know, horses. Not only, you know, were the color of the food bags the same color as the anti-personnel bombs, but also, who knows where the food's dropping? You go out there to get it, you could run into the landmine. So it's a nightmare world, and you can't use like normal rational logic about it. But if you're talking about, you know, well, a terrorist, because I heard, I think it was the White House spokesman saying, well, it's very simple to define a terrorist. Terrorist is somebody who, you know, kills innocent civilians. Well, then the U.S. is terrorist, because we kill innocent civilians in every war that we take part in. We've taken part in more wars, you know, the not since the end of World War II. We're directly responsible through covert operations and wars for at least 10 million deaths since the end of World War II. And that's Stockwell, the former CIA guy, talking from his figures, and anything else you really look at what we've done. So, I mean, if that's your definition of a terrorist, you know, then everybody's a terrorist, and there's state-level terrorism and individual terrorism. But more classically, what they wanted to mean is small groups within a larger society that are using violence in an asymmetrical guerrilla war kind of thing to take on a larger force, either within their own country or in some cases in another country. That's, I mean, the classic thing, though, was how do you throw colonialism off your back? It's got a larger military, but maybe it's a little more dispersed because the empire is large. So, you know, you stand up against it. And people will, the human community knows what the cost of violence is. They know that it has a cost not only to those they oppose, but to those that are going to carry out the violence. And not just the cost that some of them will get hurt, but that there's a moral and spiritual cost to the individual who participates in violence and does the killing. And veterans know, I mean, the dirty little secret of war is that you take the dead with you. And the killing doesn't stop. If you want to read a good book about what's actually happening now, On Killing is a book by Lieutenant David Grossman, who is a trainer in the military, and admits in the book that, you know, they knew historically that as troops got closer to each other and human face saw human face, the accuracy of the fire got diminished. And so they, people would fire into the air, they wouldn't fire, and they had this flight-fight response. So the closer troops got, the less efficient their firepower was, unless it was coming out of the air or some distance. So they consciously began in the time of the Vietnam War to break down this normal human reluctance to kill another human being. And they took off the brakes, and they trained them to go against this normal fight-fight response, as they call it, and reluctance. But then Grossman admits, honestly in the book, that they never put the brakes back on, and that these veterans go back into the society with that brake missing, and of course it's creating violence. And I remember years ago in the beginnings of the battered women's shelters, talking to the women that were running these shelters, and being told that the vast majority of the women in there were spouses or girlfriends of military veterans or police. Okay. So, and the human community knows this. I mean, even ancient tribal communities would have a cleansing ritual before you go into battle, and another cleansing ritual when you come back in order to reintegrate you into the society. You know, well, there's none of that now. You're just, as they used to say, you know, you were in Vietnam and then you were back in the world, as they called it, within 48 hours. And there was no transition. You know? And so people will bear a great deal before using violence. I mean, look at slavery. I mean, ultimately, outside of a few instances, I mean, it was not slave rebellions, you know, that eventually addressed the question. I mean, it was other political issues. But people will put up with a lot before they, a faction will then rise that'll say, well, let's use violence and let's, you know, let's throw off the yoke kind of thing. And even still, I mean, that segment will only be a small part of the population. But if the population has suffered abuse for long enough and injustice, they will give that segment support and sanctuary and sanction for a period of time in order to end the longer abuse. You know, people will put up with the short term. But they only have that support and that sanction as long as the broader abuse continues. If that ameliorates itself, if you restore justice, if you stop oppressing people, you stop abusing and exploiting them, then they're not going to support that faction. And two simple examples right now in the modern world, one would be the militia here in the United States. They have that kind of an agenda, let's go out, barricade ourselves with our guns and, you know, fight the government. Who supports them? They don't have any support because there isn't enough abuse, you know, to justify it. The IRA would be another example. There was a period in history of British colonialism and the British abuses, but the IRA became popular in Ireland, you know, and had a lot of support. But in the last 50, 100 years, many of those conditions have changed. They're not perfect, but a lot of the raw abuses are done with, you know. And so there's still a segment who continues in that mode, but they've been forced to the negotiating table because they don't have the popular support anymore. Now, if you respond in kind to terrorism, you create more terrorists. Well, Castro is a simple example of that. He goes after Batista. He goads Batista with a little attack. Batista over-responds. More people get hurt and get angry. They come over to Castro's side. Batista loses his moral authority and his leadership. Castro gains, and then he goads again. And eventually Batista collapses. Or look at Israel, where you have this constant tit-for-tat military response to, you know, some people throwing stones or people blowing themselves up in a cafe, you know. And you have this militarized response. Obviously, if war or violence was the way to peace, was the way to resolve things, the human community would have settled it long ago. But to any rational person, you can see that that's the dead-end way to go, you know. And you may have all the moral outrage and justification in the world for wanting this revenge, or this is all we can do, and violence is all that other guy understands, and all of that logic, but In the end, if you just step back, you have to be able to see that that's a dead-end proposition. It's not going to resolve the problem. In Paris, when they were doing some of the terror bombings in the 90s, the people carrying out the bombing attacks were the sons of Algerian freedom fighters from 20 years before, who had been killed by the French troops. So you get this generational rage response, and you create more enemies. You create new terrorists by responding violently to the first batch. And it's just a cycle. It's a cycle of violence. And the only way out of it is to break the cycle of violence, for one side to say, we're not going to play that game anymore, and to restore justice. If you restore justice, then you get to the root of the problem. If you maintain the injustice, maintain the arrogance, and just attack back, you're going to get more of the same in kind. And that's the lesson that nobody seems to have learned. But by now, in the 21st century, with the weapons at the level that they are, with the level of civilian deaths in war, war is just not a proposition. It's not. For the human community, for anybody that goes beyond me, mine, and the hell with you, for anybody that understands what us, ours, and let's cooperate means, for anybody that comprehends how societies work, I mean, just take it down to a neighborhood level. You know, Joe Schmo does something you don't like. Do you go over and burn down his house? No. I mean, you establish rules of law or procedure. You know, you have some kind of justice. Maybe one person recompenses the other. You negotiate something. If you go that other route, then you burn down his house, all of his, it's like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You know, so all the way from that level up, the way that you have peace in a family, in a neighborhood, in a community, or in a nation, in a world, is that you establish justice. You treat people right. You know? And that's really the secret. I mean, everybody says, why do they hate us? It's because many things have been done in the name of America abroad, much of it without the consent or even the knowledge of the American people. I mean, I had to go and study to understand what this country's been doing abroad in the last 50 years. Because the media image is that we're the nice guy, we help everybody out, we send aid all over the world, we're pro-democracy, you know. But the reality is covert operations, meddling with governments, influencing elections, putting dictators into power, oppressing, you know, civilian populations, grabbing resources. You know, we haven't been the nice guy. You know, we've been the corporate guy, we've been the guy whose face is there, you know. But it's like now, the Bush administration is celebrating the liberation of women in Afghanistan. Well, does anybody remember that in the 1970s, when Afghanistan was part of the USSR, and they had a secular, Islamic, but secular government, that women were educated, that women were a full part of the society, that they had the same rights as men did, and that it was only when the reactionary, right-wing, fundamentalist Muslim mullahs took power in a coup, that their rights were betrayed, and that they were pushed down into this status? And then when the Soviet Union came back at the behest of the people in Afghanistan to push out these reactionary mullahs and restore the rights of the people in Afghanistan, you know, and then the U.S. responded to that by funding the opposition. We funded the reactionary government that took away the liberation of women in Afghanistan. And as long as it served our purposes, we supported it. And when it got in the way of our purposes, now we're pushing it out of the way. And as a result, women are suddenly back in a different status that they used to have before we interfered. But we'll sit, you know, and the media spin is, you know, hooray for us, we love women. Well, we didn't love them so much that we wouldn't back people that oppressed them, as long as they were anti-communist. You know, and we've supported a lot of reactionary and fascist elements in countries and put them in power and kept them in power and financed them, armed them, you know, who aren't democratic. They don't care about women. They don't care about human rights or people's rights or any of that.
Talk about the media brought up after September 11th that this was just like Pearl Harbor. talk about the real parallels between that, and also discuss the fact that the White House says we couldn't have known this was coming.
The media says it's like Pearl Harbor because, well, it's multiple reasons they do, but their theme is that this is a surprise attack. It's a heinous attack. It's an attack on American soil. Like Pearl Harbor was, you know, when Japan came, we'd never been attacked in our territories or before. You know, we've never had war on the American soil, really, and outside of the Civil War, but no external war. And so the Japanese surprised us and they attacked us and it was a day of infamy, and therefore we have to, you know, pull together as a country and respond against this crime and go after this enemy. The real history of Pearl Harbor is that we goaded the attack in part because we boycotted oil going into Japan. And we created a trade boycott in Japan, which in international circles a boycott is considered an act of war. Okay. And we actively intervened there, which is not to say therefore they have the right to go blow up the fleet of Pearl Harbor and kill a bunch of people, but it's to say that when you interfere in things, things destabilize, and the militarist elements within that society then have their excuse to come to the rise and say, look what they're doing to us and we should go attack them, which is what happened. You know, so you give fuel to, I mean, if anybody with a progressive agenda, you know, at all, anybody that cares about oppressed people around the world, had, you know, 5 minutes conversation with this Osama bin Laden character, if in fact he's responsible for what happened, wouldn't they have said, no, you don't want to do this, because when you do this, the response to it is going to be worse than what it is you're trying to cure. You know, that you're going to kick off something that neither the American people nor the people around the world want to happen. You know, no matter what you think your justification is. I mean, a rational person would say, you know, this is just not the way to go about it. You know, unless you want the reactionary elements to win. So it was a goaded situation. Also, it's clear from the historical documentation that they knew Pearl Harbor was coming, that it was not a complete surprise, that they had broken what they called the East Wind Code, and which were the secret Japanese codes, because they were getting communications and cable traffic, and they were cracking them at the Office of Naval Intelligence, and that information was going up to the White House, and they knew within a few weeks ahead that there was going to be an attack there. They knew its location, and they knew that it was coming. And they let it come because it was more in their interest, Roosevelt and these others, to take a little blow. They moved part of the fleet out, you know, but even though it was a serious hit, it gave them the opportunity or the excuse to go into the war. And that seems to be, you know, what the documents now, after all these years, have finally started to be released and a thorough analysis shows. I mean, there's still debate about it, but there's certainly a case to be made. Now, you can't say, in the case of bin Laden, that this was a surprise attack. This would be as if the Japanese had attacked 7 years before and then suddenly came back and you said, whoa, what are they doing attacking us? Because bin Laden is the, you know, supposedly the key suspect, not only in the Twin Tower bombings in 93, but also, you know, in the bombing of the coal and the bombing of the embassies, because during the Clinton era, there were 75 cruise missiles sent into Sudan and Afghanistan to supposedly attack bin Laden's people, you know, and this terror network. And actually, if you go back and read about that period, the parallels of the language are exact to right now, where they're talking about these terrorist cells and what we have to do about them, you know, and people are writing in saying, hey, you're supposed to use the rule of law, not just go kill the people that you think did something, you know, and take them into court, tribunals. I mean, you know, the whole debate is going on back in 93, you know, and the same rationale that, you know, it's we have to wipe out this cell. And so you know, it was somebody that was high on the radar screen of who's against us and who's our enemy, had already attacked us in a number of instances, according to the official version. And so it wasn't somebody that came out of the blue. It also wasn't a type of attack that had never been done before. There were instances where the same Al-Qaeda network, because bin Laden didn't just work in Afghanistan. He was in Kosovo, he was in Chechnya, he was in Uzbekistan, he was in Paris even, you know, and other places around the world through this network. And also, he was known to the United States. I mean, there's one analysis being made right now, and I think it has some merit to it, that what the United States is doing by going in and bombing all of these cave complexes is that actually, since NATO and the United States built these complexes on behalf of the war against the Soviet Union, that they're going in now and wiping out the evidence of their complicity and connection to the operations. And they're going in and grabbing all these computers and documents and everything. That part of that is to clean up the history that exists right to the current day of a connection between Pakistani intelligence, U.S. intelligence, Saudi intelligence, and bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. A lot of the left, to the extent that it's being conspiratorial at all, is saying that this is blowback, which is an unintended consequence of an intelligence operation. I don't believe it's blowback. I believe that bin Laden, had he been really acting as an independent element against U.S. interests, would have been wiped out. And it came as no surprise to me that we didn't capture or kill bin Laden. I said from the start that they would not. And they began to hedge their bets. They started at the beginning saying, we know who did this and we're going to go get him. Then they said, oh, we have to smoke him out and then we'll get him. Then they said, well, you know, he's only one among many and it doesn't matter, we'll get him eventually. We don't have to get him right now. Then they said, getting him isn't our mission. Then they said, we don't know if he's there or not. Then they said, they don't know if he's alive or not. And now it's like, well, you know, we don't know, but we'll get him. Don't worry about it, we'll get him. We got other people to get now. Well, to me, he was always, from the beginning, worth more to them as a will-o'-the-wisp who can go into any country and then that country can be bombed, you know, than a dead slat. I mean, you kill bin Laden tomorrow, American people are going to say, breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, our problem's solved. How are you going to convince them that you have to keep going? So yeah, leave them alive. Almost everybody they've demonized in the current warfare scenarios is still alive and kicking around. I mean, you think about Noriega or Saddam Hussein or, you know, all these people that suddenly come up on the radar screen and they get to be the devil for their 15 minutes, you know. They really don't go get them. And so I don't think they really intended to. And I think that really goes all the way back even to Castro. Because Castro, I think, was useful to them. There were elements of the CIA that actually financed Castro into power. There were a certain segment that wanted Prius Sakaris and the mob guys, and then there were CIA guys that were running guns to Castro. In fact, Jack Ruby and a guy named McWillie were running guns for the CIA to Castro and wanted him to come into power. But then what happened was the U.S. forces wouldn't finance him, and so he turned than to the East to get, you know, his support. But there's this whole story, and I'm sure you've heard it, that the mob and the CIA aligned at some point in order to kill Castro. And they had this Operation Mongoose, and they tried to tie Bobby Kennedy into this, and they tried to say that was blowback too, that it ended up with the same people that they prepped to kill Castro, killing John F. Kennedy, and then Bobby, you know, realized he was to blame. Bobby, I believe, was put into the CIA and Mongoose to stop it. I don't believe that the Kennedys knew that there were plans to kill Castro. Kennedys were very upset about the assassination of ZM when they found out that happened. And when I think when they had already stopped the raids on Cuba, and I think when they found out about Mongoose and to actually kill Castro, they went in and you know, put an end to it and were actually trying to normalize relations with Castro, which was leaked. Part of how Kennedy got killed is that fact was leaked through the intelligence community to the anti-Castro Cubans, which infuriated them, and then that guaranteed their operation, and the mechanical level, their cooperation with trying to kill Kennedy. So I think many groups were involved by the people that actually killed Kennedy on the top, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, involved rogue elements of the CIA, elements of the Anticastro Cubans and the mob in the hit at the time on the mechanical level, so they could take credit then and pat themselves on the back. But later, if necessary, they could take blame rather than the blame. It's like the fingers, but you can't see the palm, the wheel of fingers. So all those are up there. But I don't think that was really true. I don't think they ever really intended to kill Castro. And these stories of exploding cigars and shellfish talked and all this crazy stuff that they were doing, I think it's just smoke. I think they sat up at nights, you know, and thought up some nutty stuff to tell people that they were going to. When Giancana and some of the other mobsters, Marcello, were brought in the House Select Committee in the 70s to, and the Church Committee to look into these assassination plots, Frank Regano, who was the attorney to both Marcello and Giancana, told the story that Marcello went into the hearings, and coming out, he asked them, they were closed hearings, and he asked them, what did they want to know? And Marcello said, oh, they want to know about, you know, were we part of a plot to kill Castro? And he said, well, what'd you tell him? He said, I told him the truth. He said, we were never trying to kill Castro. And I think that that is the truth, that the Castro killing story was the cover story for them developing a domestic assassination capability that killed Kennedy. But if anybody ever asked what they were doing, oh, we're training to kill Castro. Because if they can kill Kennedy, they can sure as hell kill Castro. So why is Castro still alive? Because he served their purposes, the whipping boy, the immediate threat, 90 miles, you know, from the Cuban Missile Crisis on, as a way to, you know, which says, not, doesn't say anything about Castro himself necessarily, but it says something about how we use our enemies, how we create them, and what good they do us, you know, or do the portion of us that want to make profit off war, and the maintenance of social hegemony through war and warfare and militarism. And so in the same sense, it doesn't surprise me that they didn't get bin Laden, but bin Laden was on their radar screen, his organization clearly was, and there had been instances in the Soviet Union, in Chechnya, and in Paris, where planes had been used as weapons by the Al-Qaeda. So even the method of attack was not unknown. I saw one thing, I've been able to verify it, but one report from somebody who said he was a longtime tenant of the building, of the Twin Tower buildings, who said that those buildings are in restricted airspace and they have surface-to-air missiles on those buildings to protect themselves. Well, I don't know if it's true, but I mean, it's sensible, you know. The only thing to think about is, you know, this is the World Trade Center, right? See, I started the Kennedy assassination work back in 1968. And Jim Garrison went after a guy named Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw was in Europe part of something that began under the title of Permanent Industrial Exhibits, or Permindex. And Permindex formed in Italy a group called Centro Commerciale Mondiale, which means World Trade Center. And the idea was to set up these trade centers so that international exhibits could become permanent in places, you know, as a way for people to come and look at goods and buy the goods and sort of, you know, establish these trade relations at fixed locations. There was one in Dallas. That was where Kennedy was supposed to give his luncheon talk, had he gotten there. There was one in New Orleans, where Oswald was leafleting outside and Clay Shaw was working inside. But they come out of this beginnings as Permindex, which included very top money in the Italian infrastructure, and a lot of fascists, a lot of the fascist money, you know, in the post-World War II period. And Clay Shaw, despite his denials at the trial and the effort to block him by the CIA and others, block Garrison from finding it out, was a contract agent of the CIA and was regularly used by the CIA. And in fact, if you go and look at the documents that have been released now, they bear out Garrison and they show that CMC, Central Commercial Mondial, would put up money for specific trips that Shaw was making on behalf of the CIA and then reporting back when he was done from these international trips. So I would just say the World Trade Centers have had a great deal to do with the history of modern intelligence operations and policy, haven't they? I mean, what is this thing that every time there's like a major shift in power, it somehow involves World Trade Center? And so that's what got hit in New York. I looked up the firms that are in the building, and they were basically the Eastern establishment. You know, Morgan Stanley and the big banking firms and the stock exchange, and, you know, that's what fell down that day, you know. And that's different money than what's in Texas or what's in, you know, most of Bush's circle. Bush crosses over somewhat into both camps, but, you know, the people that are in there at the top of the Bush administration mostly come from different money than the old banking establishment money that was destroyed in the building that day. And there are international links between the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. There's longtime interconnections with the Saudi royal family, which is really where the Bin Ladens family is. It's a Saudi family. Mm-hmm. These were considered Saudi Afghans, you know. And Saudi intelligence was putting up money to Bin Laden right through September 11. One of the main heads of Saudi intelligence was knocked off afterwards because he was pro Bin Laden. Also, the head of Pakistani intelligence was lopped off in October on the basis that not only had he been the main funding conduit for Bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda, but he had also given $100,000 directly, I think in August, was when it happened, to Mohammed Atta, who's considered the mastermind behind the plot that day. But that guy, even though he was knocked off of the head of Pakistani intelligence in October, in September, on the 4th of September, was here in the United States. He was here in the United States meeting with elements of the CIA and with Richard Armitage at the State Department. Richard Armitage figures into the old Iran-Contra scandal with Oliver North and, you know, and the other top guys in the company and the international drug trade stuff that they were involved with and the Contra operations. It's interesting now that it's come out in a Sarasota paper that Mohammed Atta was staying in Florida when he lived down there for a period in the house of one of the Iran-Contra pilots. So this may be the old Iran-Contra team internally working. And I was just told by a guy here in Seattle who is currently in the National Guard that the Delta Force was operating here in the United States after, like on and after September 11. They're not supposed to operate internally. And Delta Force was Secord's operation. It's high level military intelligence, and you know, it's for international intervention. Delta Force ran the failed helicopter raid on Tehran, which I also believe was a planned operation, planned to fail, planned to embarrass Carter, because I don't think 8 helicopters can take Tehran. I'm sorry, even if they're full of Americans.
What would Delta Force be doing right now, since September 11th in the U.S.? Did they give you an impression of what that was?
No, I guess it was security stuff, but I mean, you know, I think they're only designed to operate abroad.
Right.
That's my understanding anyway. And the secretary for Secord at Delta Force, just a coincidence, you know, I'm a coincidence theorist, was Linda Tripp, 16, GS-16, you know, top level Army intelligence operative from the Bush era, who was left over at the Clinton White House, who was friends with Monica Lewinsky, who gave the tapes, suggested that she tape, and then gave the tapes to Lucianne Goldberg. Lucianne Goldberg has her own history going back to World War II. Her husband Arthur Goldberg and she were members of North American Newspaper Alliance, and that's how she identified herself when she came to the fore in the scandal. She is a public relations and disinformation expert, in my view, an intelligence operative, who's worked on the inside for years, but she was, among other things, a public relations person for Mark Furman, the racist cop in Los Angeles in the O.J. Simpson trial. But in the post World War II period, Arthur Goldberg, her husband, worked directly. NANA was formed out of Lord Beaverbrook and British naval intelligence circles, and Laura Beaverbrook, who ran the London Sunday Times, as a cover for intelligence agents to go abroad as journalists, and also as a way to plant intelligence disinformation stories through a supposedly legitimate news network. And so Nana had operatives all over the world. Hemingway, for a period, worked with Nana. And he had worked also with U.S. intelligence and the French resistance coming into France at the fall of the Germans. And he worked there with David Bruce, who was his best man at his wedding. Bruce later was part of the CIA and the Middle East desk of the CIA. It was David Bruce and Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, who later got a job with Saucony Mobil Oil, and Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., who in the 1950s pulled the coup in Iran to take Mossadegh, an elected nationalist who wanted to nationalize the oil industry there, and overthrow him and put in the Shah, who would cooperate with the U.S. and British oil interests instead. And then, of course, years later, Norman Schwarzkopf Jr., you know, was chosen as the guy to head up, our Gulf War. But the discovery of the Dolmen Dome in Saudi Arabia, the largest oil deposit to date in that period, in 1943, was in a period when England was under severe attack and had pulled back from in order to defend the homeland. And so Averell Harriman wrote a letter to Roosevelt, the president, saying that there was all this oil in Saudi Arabia that wasn't being protected and the Germans would get at it. So Roosevelt sent 30,000 troops to guard the Dolmen Dome oil, headed by Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., who had been West Point in World War I, brought back into World War II, and then the son brought back in for it. And later the father had done gangbusters, and he'd been the head of the state troopers in New Jersey, the father had, and militarized them, and also was responsible for the framing of Bruno Hauptmann in the Charles Lindbergh kidnapping. So these guys, they're in positions and they figure throughout history, but David Bruce and the OSS, and Hemingway working with the OSS, and OSS came out of British intelligence and was linked to British intelligence. And in fact, Ian Fleming, who was way up in naval intelligence in Britain, and later wrote the James Bond novels, and his brother Peter Fleming, who was even higher up than he was, and worked on Operation Sea Lion, But Ian Fleming was the guy that founded, on behalf of Lord Beaverbrook and British intelligence, North American Newspaper Alliance. So his Russian desk guy was Arthur Goldberg, and Lucianne Goldberg was working for him at the same time. And they, in turn, hired a woman named Priscilla Johnson, who was the first person to interview the defector Lee Harvey Oswald at the Metropole, on the suggestion of a guy named Snyder at the Russian embassy, who was naval intelligence for the U.S. U.S. naval intelligence is the largest and oldest intelligence network, and it grew out of British naval intelligence, which had run the empire for 500 years. And then there was another woman, Aileen Mosby, who worked for NANA, but also worked for UPI, who interviewed Oswald. And so those are the early Oswald the Red stories backing up Oswald, who himself was naval intelligence and had a crypto clearance in the Marines and went everywhere the U-2 was stationed. And I'll tell you a local story, because I live around D.C. I went into Dulles Airport. This was probably mid-90s. And it's we have wonderful airports. We have an airport now that's named after Ronald Reagan and one named after Alan W. Dulles, you know, and so thank you. But Dulles Airport's out there in the Virginia Sticks, and they had an exhibit up at the airport about reconnaissance photography, satellite photography, and what you can see from a satellite and how it helped U.S. intelligence. But it was a phony exhibit, because the examples that they would show of these photos, satellite photos, were like fuzzy overviews of towns without much detail and some roofs and, you know, no detail. You can see a golf ball. You can read a license plate. You can discern the expression on my face from a satellite, as long as there's nothing in the way, you know. And then they also use computers now to resolve through cloud cover and get better images, and, you know, they have a lot of techniques, infrared and things that can look at things. And then they also have remotely piloted vehicles that can go up under cloud cover or beyond horizon and feed back to the satellites from a better location to do that. And they've had that since the end of World War II. The British had 100,000 remotely piloted vehicles up in the air for reconnaissance purposes after World War II, so at different points. But they were doing spying, and of course, part of this exhibit is the beginnings of it, which is the U-2 and this spy plane that went down in the Soviet Union while Oswald was there. And Oswald, in his diary, said he went to visit Gary Powers. And there's a lot of evidence, and Gary Powers eventually said it himself, that the U.S. shot the plane down by blowing it up, stopping the engine and then causing it to crash rather than the Soviet missile hitting it. And it was because they were on the verge of a detente between Eisenhower and Khrushchev. And so by creating this international incident, the U.S. was that was my introduction to like government perfidy, because I thought only those lousy Russians spied. You know, and now suddenly here we have to admit that we're spying, and we've been lying to the American public about what this plane was doing. And, you know, Adlai Stevenson is furious because they lied to him, and he's representing one thing in the UN and the other thing is true. And then Eisenhower has to make the admission, and then Khrushchev is furious, and the whole detente breaks apart. So, but Powers finally, you know, admitted about 2 weeks before he died in this strange helicopter crash over Los Angeles when he was doing like traffic stuff from a helicopter. 2 weeks after he said this on the radio, that he thought the United States brought his plane down, then his helicopter went down and killed him. And but Gary Powers is there, and there's this incident with the U-2. So they show the U-2 model in this exhibit, and then they show a glossy photograph of some Quonset huts and some long trailers that they say are one of the pieces of evidence that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, that these photos were trailers that were bringing the bombs in, you know, the nuclear weapons, and they were being stored in these Quonset huts. And they're fairly clear. I mean, you can see these buildings and trucks and things like that from the U-2 going over and taking these pictures. Well, what I noticed, and 99.9% of the American public, if they noticed this, would take no meaning from it, I'm sure. But I'm looking at this photo, and at the bottom, there's this, and it's an actual glossy photo from the time, typed across in these old typewriter letters is, courtesy of Jagger Charles Stovall. Jagger Charles Stovall was a firm in Dallas that did photo analysis work for the Office of Naval Intelligence and the NSA in 1963. In 1961, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so it's telling me that these pictures came through this subcontracted firm, having been analyzed by them from the U-2. In other words, they were analyzing the U-2 photos. And they gave this. But the significance is that one of the employees in 1961 of Jagger Charles Stovall is none other than Lee Harvey Oswald. And he was their photo expert, and he knew how to do photo enlargement and photo reduction down to microdot level. And he, in fact, subcontracted not to Jagger Charles Stovall, which didn't have good enough photographic equipment. He went over to a public relations firm, Saul Bloom Agency, where Jack Peterbaugh and Elizabeth Forsling worked, and he did the photo work there, and he went over there about 60 times and did this work. Well, it was Jack Peterbaugh and Elizabeth Forsling, later Harris, but it was Elizabeth Forsling then before she married Leon Harris from the department stores. Those two were called by Bill Moyers as the front operatives for the motorcade through Dallas, in which Kennedy was killed, and they set up the motorcade route. So Oswald was at both shops. But when I saw Jagger Charles Stovall on this photograph of what started the Cuban Missile Crisis coming out of the shop where Oswald did the analysis, I mean, what does that tell you? You know. But as I say, 99.9% of the American public would see that and it wouldn't have any meaning to them. But it's only the devil's in the details. You know. I mean, and the way you figure things out is that you have to go and do your homework. And you have to understand who people are and what these companies are and what histories they have. You know, Hillary Clinton said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, and she told the press, go look into the backgrounds of these people. But nobody did. I did. I mean, I know who Linda Tripp is. I know where she comes from. I know where Lucienne Goldberg is. And this is an intelligence operation against Clinton. It's a created scandal, you see. But people don't look at it. So there were all kind of operational changes on September the 11th. And there were calls right away for a 10-year war. They kept talking about a 10-year war. That was significant to me because my mother revealed to me after all those years at the Pentagon that she had actually reversed plans that Kennedy had revealed in April, and those were a reversal. So there were two reversals. In April of 1963, orders came from the White House that caused a reversal in her projections. Her job was to project the overall national draft call for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She was a manpower analyst under the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, Desper, in the Pentagon. They would give her a current force level and a force level where they wanted to be 5 years down the pike. And she would have to project each year in between how many would die, how many would reenlist, how many would retire, how many would join up, you know, and therefore how many would they have to draft in order to get to the force level, whether it was up or down, 5 years from then. And she had like actuarial tables to figure those percentages out. If they were going to be in a combat, then there was a Department of Operations at the Pentagon that would send her combat attrition figures. How many were wounded, how many died, that she would have to figure into that. And then she told me the figure she came up with for each annual national call in those 5 years, which could get up to, you know, 50,000 people in Vietnam, that she had to project that accurately enough that they could be right within 100 people either way for the year. Okay? And then they'd take whatever figure she had and they'd multiply it by 5. And that was because she told me 50 to 55% would flunk the physical of those eligible. Another 10 to 15% would get a deferment or exemption. Another 10 to 15% would no-show or resist. And then they were back to the 20% they needed in the first place. And so they projected those figures out, and I remember her sweating them coming in 5 years later each year, what she had done before. But she had to project that accurately, and in April of 63, for the first time in her career, they told her to reverse the projections, and they said on the orders of the White House, we want a full withdrawal of troops from Vietnam by the end of 64. This is April 1963. So she puts those figures in, and then I asked her after she retired, when did they tell you that they would escalate the war in Vietnam, because she had to be among the first to know. And she said late November, 63. I said last week in November, because he shot on the 22nd. She said the Monday following the assassination, 25th. I said, was this a few more advisors? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. She said, I took them back up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I said, these can't be right. This is November 25, 63. Kennedy's literally just in the grave. Okay? And they're doing a complete reversal of his Vietnam policy. And they're telling my mother to project a 10-year war with 57,000 dead. Right on target. They knew when they started, where they were going, what it was going to cost. So when you hear, you know, these revelations now by McNamara that it was going to be a costly war, that's how costly they knew it was going to be. In 63 they knew, and the final figure was something like 57.5 for the deaths. And they had it on target, and I used to tease my mother that that was the first civilian protest of the war, when she went up and couldn't believe the figures. The war freaked her out. The level of civilian death, the napalm, the personnel weapons that they were using. And my mother had been a pacifist between World War I and World War II, had decided, as many did, that Hitler had to be opposed, then made the transition that many did, that Hitler was dead, but now Stalin was the same thing, you know, and the Soviets had to be opposed, and then came into through the Cold War, backing them up, but when they got to Vietnam, it began to erode, you know, her sense of more moral righteousness about it. And eventually she helped me put together charts for a book that I never finished called Unassessed Heritage, Ecocide, Ethnocide, and Genocide in Vietnam. Mm. Tremendous destruction in the country. But in any case, I knew from that they plan wars 10 years in advance, and they plan them quite accurately. So when I heard these statements from the top Bush administration officials in the days following September 11 that we're going into a 10-year war, and then finally there was a statement by Cheney saying, the war may not end in your lifetime. In other words, a permanent war. Back to a permanent war economy, back to a tax economy that gives the bulk of the money to the military and creates a recession, a worse recession than was already in place. Because prior to September 11, there was already a worldwide economic slump. There was already a recession. There was already an end to the surplus that they claimed was going to come off of the tax dollars, feeding into a deficit. And there was already a situation where Bush was saying, cut taxes, increase military spending, increase intelligence spending. There were also calls to unshackle the CIA from the Frank Church Committee years and let it do what it hadn't done. The funniest thing to me about that was all these people at Congress were standing up saying how the CIA couldn't operate and it needed all these authorities. They went over and interviewed an analyst at the CIA, a top-level analyst, and he said, well, these people are misguided. He said, we don't need those authorities. Well, of course they don't, because they do what they want to do, regardless of them. And if you give them to them openly, then they have to take responsibility for them. It's like going to a hitman and saying, hey, we're going to make it legal. Well, the hitman is going to say, whoa, wait a minute, you're going to blow my cover, and now from now on, when anybody's killed that looks suspicious, I'm going to get blamed. So just leave it the way it is. You know, it's not legal for me what I'm doing, and then I have a denial, you know. But so they're like pushing the CIA into this position. Like Woodward now claiming in this series that Tenet went over and asked for all this stuff and the right to assassinate. But they always had the right to assassinate, and the only thing that was really taken away was for them to do assassinations without any national emergency involved. But Clinton put out orders to assassinate Osama bin Laden, and they were technically legal orders under the thing, because there had been, you know, this attack and it involved national security. So they have the usual loophole for this stuff. It's just that they can't go into a country where they have nothing going on except their corporate interests and legally say, well, kill the ruler, we don't like this guy. But they were doing it anyway. They just were, you know, doing it where they had plausible deniability.